Hello, I'm Lulu.
Hello, I'm Lulu's mother, Sandra, and this is Inside the Jewel Box.
Inside the Jewel Box is a podcast in which my mother and I meet with fascinating people from Aotearoa and inquire into the objects that give meaning to their lives.
When my darling daughter suggested a podcast about the objects that give our lives meaning, I told her I'd love to hear the stories of those objects that people hold close. In the podcast, Lulu and I talk to wonderful people about objects they have loved, desired, and mourned for. Join us in this conversation. This is Inside the Jewel Box.
In this episode, we interview Hamish Coney about his three chosen objects.
Hamish trained as an art historian. His involvement in researching, preserving, and shaping our cultural landscape takes multiple forms. In the last few years, he's moved away from working mostly in a market-related context after leaving his role as Managing Director for Art and Object, where he was for 12 years. His recent projects are vast and they're fascinating. He's working with James Parkinson on valuing the cultural aspects of Museum of New Zealand Te Papa Tongarewa. This year, they're valuing its fine art collection, which alone consists of 15,000 artworks.
Hamish works in building meaningful and significant collections for private collectors. He works as a curator, advisor, and writer. In 2020, Hamish and Dr. Kerri-Ann Wikitera co-authored the book Hine Mihi Te Hokinga, The Return, which is a celebration of one of New Zealand's most distinguished photographic artists, Mark Adams. The accompanying exhibition was at Two Rooms Gallery in the same year. In 2020, he was guest curator at the Adam Art Gallery, Te Pātika, for the exhibition Tēnei, Aotūroa, where he again brought together photography by Mark Adams of the Whare Whakaero Hine Mihi o Te Ao Tawhito and Whakaero by its creators Tēnei Waitere and Wero Tāroi. Hamish is also working on several book concepts at the moment.
We know that it was very hard for you to choose the objects because I think it would be fair to say that everything that comes under your purvey could be collectible. You have so many collections to actually draw on. So we're going to be very interested to see what you have chosen as significant. So again, welcome.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
So should we begin with the first object that you've chosen?
Sure. The first object that I've chosen is in an area that's very dear to me, which is New Zealand photography. And the items that I'm going to talk about today really span 100 years of New Zealand photography, from the 1880s to the 1980s. The first object that I have chosen is a photograph by Mark Adams, which dates to 1986. And it's an image which was on the cover of what I regard as one of the most important exhibitions from that period. It's called Pākehā Māori, A Conjuncture. The full title is Documentary Photographs Taken in Rotorua in the period 1975 to 1986 by Mark Adams. The show was curated by the legendary John Perry, of whom we're going to hear a little bit more about. And there's a lovely connection to one of your previous interviewees. We'll talk about that in a second. But this photograph by Mark is from this wonderful catalogue, and it's an image of a gateway, a waharoa, cast in concrete in the form effectively of a weku head figure from Rotorua and through which drove a model railway that generations of kids in Rotorua would have enjoyed as they tootled around the park. The full title of the work, as inscribed here by Mark, is 9686 Gateway, construction by Nelson Tomlin Neil Gower, circa 1966, the Toot and Whistle Steam Railway, Kuiro Park, Rotorua. And this is part of a body of work of Mark's, which is, you know, he's now had 5 decades of practice in this cross-cultural space. And Pākehā Māori, A Conjuncture, is a really important photograph the catalogue and the exhibition was a really important exhibition because it's one of the first exhibitions that really explores whakaero and whakaero derivations, for example, in folk art form, as they are found on the street in everyday life. So this includes really important sites and examples of carving in and around Rotorua. It's also, incidentally, I think, a really important catalogue because it's one of the very first that was bilingual, published in Te Reo Māori and English in 1986. And it speaks to a photographer whose work I'm very close to and who I've collaborated with and curated shows with, but also the legacy of one of our great collectors and museum directors, John Perry, who died a couple of years ago.
With the photograph on the front page, does that still exist now?
No, I think that may well be long gone, the actual site itself. But a couple of years ago, when I first acquired this photograph, and that would have been about a year after John died, John passed away in 2021. And then Webbs, the auction house, began selling off in catalogue form John's vast collection of, you name it, it's there. And there's, and I've also had a lot to do with John. John was a personal mentor to me when I started the Auction House Art and Object in 2007. So I was absolutely delighted to be able to acquire this photograph by Mark from John's collection. And John's feel for the wider cultural resonance of folk art, and of course, folk art always has an original cultural beginning point that is kind of legitimate and tūturu, you know, is the real thing. Folk art is always like the wider cultural doggerel of original cultural manifestations. And in this case, what this exhibition does back in 1986 is via Mark Adams' photographs, go to the original sites of some of the key sites of carving in Rotorua, some of which are long gone, so he documents the sites. Some of them are still important sites where, well, back in the 80s, the carving was still extant and standing, particularly the work of Tēnā Waitere. And then some of the folk art derivations, particularly as it relates to the tourism trade. You know, tikis on the side of motels. This weku head gateway form that was part of a children's toot and whistle miniature train fun ride in a park in Rotorua. So it's a really interesting journey in one of the heartlands of whakaero, you know, the Ngāti Tarawhai, the wider Te Arawa carving tradition.
It's also a slightly haunting image, because you think of little tamariki in little railway carriages on a track going through this gateway. It sort of offers up a slightly transformational experience when you look at what looks like mist or smoke.
It's probably a sulphur vent. You know, and when I've been going to Rotorua, my family has, for many, many decades. I mean, it's still the case now, but I recall as a boy first going to places like Tikatere, Hell's Gate and various other places, even Whakarewarewa. And what can I say? The public safety aspect of access to boiling water, mud pools, is not as stringent as it is today, or wasn't then. And so as a kid, you could literally put your nose into some of these things and, you know, be shrieked at by your parents or your grandmother or your uncles. But of course, that whole Rotorua, the thermal wonderland aspect of the region was something that as a kid so many New Zealanders have connected with as a memory. In fact, when I first bought this photograph, I did a post on Instagram, and I can't tell you the number of notes and messages I got frequently from people that I know, but also lots of other people I didn't know, going, oh, I had to go on that train, you know, when I was a kid, and I remember that park, and oh my God, I used to go to the Toot and Whistle every time I went to Rotorua. So it's a photograph that has got a lot of resonance. And one of the lovely aspects to it is it's kind of got a connection to childhood. It's got a connection to when, you know, Roto Vegas was a really big tourism destination in New Zealand. And, of course, through Mark Adams' photography, we're able to burrow into the primary cultural sources that even today, in fact, even more today, when you look at the Rotorua waterfront and that lovely new thermal springs Waiariki, that the Whakaero aspect of Rotorua is richer now, I think, than it's almost ever been.
Again, from that era, the rubber tyres used as low barricades, I suppose. Rubber tyres were used for everything then. Yeah. And is this eucalyptus?
Probably. You know, it's a kind of an interloper. I think one of the incredible aspects of Mark Adams' photography is that it's ostensibly, at first look, a documentary photograph. But soon, the kind of the poetry of the image, the choice of the artist, everything that's taking place outside the picture frame starts to inform your reading of the image. And that's one of the things that I think makes Mark Adams such a great artist. Of course, he's got an amazing eye, you know, the way that he frames an image, but his choices of what he photographs, given that he uses still a plate camera, as photographers did back in the 1880s, and that is the connection on a technical level between Mark's photography today. He still takes photographs in the same way, but it places him within a great tradition of photography that goes back to its earliest days, which we're going to talk about when we get onto one of the other images. But for me, of course, there's my personal connection to Mark, there's my personal connection to John Perry, somebody who is very dear to me. You know, he's got a really important role to play in the culture, John. He was the person, through his intervention, that brought Teo Skoon back to New Zealand in the 1980s. In fact, literally the year before this show, there was the great Teo Skoon show curated by John Perry at the Rotorua Museum. And John is somebody who has a wonderful eye and really was one of the great collectors in New Zealand history. And what he didn't know about a myriad of subjects, particularly in the area of folk art, Maori carving, historic photography, gum carving, shells, tapa, the list goes on. John was literally a source of incredible knowledge, and he was very generous in sharing that.
Before we go on to the next object, Sandy, what are your reflections on what Hamish has just said?
I think Hamish has been very clever with his choice of this particular photograph of Mark Adams. It literally is of a type of a gateway. But in his conversation with us, he's also taking us through another gateway and taking us from Mark Adams' photograph to his photography in general and through to John Perry, one of this country's most important collectors and someone who has shaped the aesthetic of quite a few collectors.
Thanks, Sandy. Now, back to our interview with Hamish. You're listening to Inside the Jewel Box.
Hamish, you were holding a very fragile glass plate. This is your second image. So if you'd like to tell us what it is and why it holds such significance to you.
I am holding an original negative, a glass plate by the photographer Elizabeth Pullman of three guides or three significant figures in front of standing, posing for a photograph, what I think is one of the great New Zealand photographs, taken in the early 1980s of guide Kate Middlemass, guide Sophia, the Duchess of the Terraces, as she was referred to, and Nareta, who was the wife of Aparo Te Whare Kaniwha, who was the Tūhorangi chief who commissioned the carving of Hinemihi o Te Ao Tawhito. This is the original glass plate from which I recently acquired an album which has a copy of that photograph of Kate, Sophia and Nareta there, dating to about 1882. It measures roughly 25 by 30 centimetres, 10 by 8 inches, and the quality of the reproduction that you get off what is effectively a negative this size means that this image could be scanned, and I have scanned it. You could blow it up to billboard size, and the integrity of the image would be kind of forensic in its detail. That's exactly what a glass plate looks like. In an era of fugitive digital images, this is a photographic taonga, a real live, good to go. It's a bit knocked around, one of the corners has come off, and it's got a few scratches on it, but that there is the photograph as taken in the mid-1880s. That's what the photographer would have made that print from that I have recently acquired. So you can imagine how excited I was when I saw this come up at auction recently at Cordy's. This is one of seven original Pullman glass plates that I acquired. Not quite sure what I'm going to do to them. I guess ultimately I'll donate these to a museum. But what we're doing now is we're really getting into the entrails of New Zealand photographic history, and there's a lot going on in this image, and there's enormous kinship with Mark Adams' practice, particularly in and around that very house, Hinemihi, where it's standing there at Te Wairoa before the eruption. But this is an image which for me is just groaning with so much interesting art history, cultural history, commercial history, and it's a foundational image in how New Zealand at the time, and still very much to this day, presented itself to the world. It also speaks to what I believe is the beginnings of celebrity culture, because Guide Sophia was one of New Zealand's first celebrities. Her image, the Duchess of the Terraces, was distributed around the world via postcards, and she was, along with, I'd say, Tawhio of that period, you know, the Kingitanga leader, one of the most photographed New Zealanders in the 1870s and 1880s. And Guide Sophia is a celebrity, along with Guide Rangi, later on, are still legendary figures in New Zealand culture. And that's a beautiful, lovely image of three of the personalities of the day in what was at the time probably the most visited location by international visitors to New Zealand prior to the eruption of Mount Tarawera in 1886.
This image also has have a nice relationship to our last interviewee, Rose Evans.
They do. When I was listening, preparing for today, hoping to be brief, of course, I listened to Rose's podcast from Inside the Jewel Box a couple of months ago. And my ears were out on stalks when she talked about one of the things that she collects is the volcanic sand bottles that were such a feature of kind of the Rotorua homespun tourism industry back in the day. They date from the sort of the 40s to the 60s, I think. When I was a boy first visiting, you could buy test tubes. Remember, you could get the little test tubes of the volcanic sand with a cork stopper? Well, when I heard Rose mentioning that these were amongst her prize collectibles, and she mentioned where she got them from, I started to put two and two together and sort of had a bit of a speculation. My final act as Managing Director of Art and Object in late 2018, I started that business with my partners in 2007. My final act was to present a selection of John Perry's collection. Now, John, of course, was the director of the Rotorua Museum for well over a decade in the 80s and 90s, and he curated the show that we've just discussed. And in early 2018, John, and he was a regular visitor, you know, John was a regular visitor. He'd come to all the auctions and he was always interested in things. And, you know, when frequently we didn't know what something might be, or we felt like we needed a little bit of a hand in working out what it was, suddenly John would appear and he would always know what it was. And so he was a great source of cultural information. And he spans, if you like, the fine art space through to the popular culture and the folk art space. Very few people have got that broad widescreen view. Most people are high art or low art. John was both. And he, at that stage, I mean, John passed away in 2021, and he started talking about, in his own way, the ways he would describe things. He would say, look, I've travelled the world many times over in my mind via books and films and objects, you know, the collecting of objects. But he hadn't been really out there in the world, to Paris, to London, to the States, wherever he wanted to go, to all the museums of Europe. So I sort of said to him, well, why don't we put together a selection of your collection so that you can raise some money to have your great, your grand tour, John Perry's grand tour. And so that idea sort of stuck hold. And so I would go up to Helensville. I'm sure that many of your listeners will have visited John over the years up in Helensville in the old cinema up there that was just groaning with, look, everything. Old posters, photographs, ceramics, folk art, gum carving heads. That was something that he absolutely loved, was old Kauri gum carving. And I would go up there and literally fight with John to be able to leave with a bootload of material, and it took about 10 trips to put the collection together. And some of those items, or a couple of those items, were small collections, museum quality in my view, of the volcanic ash, the volcanic sands, you know, the sulfur colours, lovely, beautiful colours, all layered up in those beautiful bottles. And it turns out that Rose acquired those very same things from John's collection in this catalogue that we're looking at right now in, October 2018. So that was lovely to hear her talking about how much she loved those objects and how hard it is to find them, because they are hard to find. And of course, John Perry had 7 or 8 of them. And I think, I don't know how many of them she bought. I think we put them to 2 or 3 lots, and she bought them from that very same auction.
Tell us a little bit about Elizabeth Pullman, too.
Look, I think Elizabeth Pullman is a super important figure in the story of New Zealand photography. If we look back at our foundation photographers, and I'm going to move on from the very first images, you know, the 1850s and 60s, to that group of photographers who really established the visual language in photographic terms of New Zealand in the 1870s to the 1890s. And you have the Burton brothers, you have Josiah Martin, you have George Valentine, Charles Spencer. But Elizabeth Pullman is really our first great female photographer. There's a show to be had, there's a book to be written about Elizabeth Pullman, and she gets a lot of coverage in Lisa Mitchell's book, which was published last year, called Through Shaded Glass, which I think is an absolutely extraordinary book. You know, there is names in here who will ultimately get much expanded treatment. Thelma Kent is another one in the 1930s. But Elizabeth Pullman she was a businesswoman and a photographer. And so she ran a very successful photographic studio. Portraits are kind of the bread and butter of studio photographers back in the day. Weddings, graduations, you name it. Young men going off to war. Graduation photographs of everybody in their sort of caps and gowns. Debutantes, whatever it might be. Politicians, worthies in their finery. But also Elizabeth Pullman was a really important photographer of Maori subjects, and she was down there along with everybody else. Like I mentioned, it was a bit of a photographic gold rush in the early 1880s, photographing there at Te Wairoa in and around Lake Rotamahana and the Pink and White Terraces. And so there's some really good mention in Through Shaded Glass, but I think that Elizabeth Pullman's photographs right there in the first rank, and she has a very long career from the 1870s right through to, I think, the early 20th century. So she ran a very successful, long-standing studio for many decades, and her portrait of King Tawhito is one of the most well-known photographs in Aotearoa. I've got an album full of Elizabeth Pullman images here, which I bought recently at auction. And as I said, I've got 7 original glass plates. At some stage, her archive was acquired by the New Zealand Government Tourism Department. And so this one here has got the stamp, as they all do, of the ones that I bought. And I think that she is a photographer who is really worthy of expanded treatment curatorially and in a publishing sense in the future.
Lulu, had you heard of Elizabeth Pullman, the photographer?
No, I hadn't heard about her before we interviewed Hamish. And after the interview, I did look her up. She's a really interesting person. Her and her first husband ran a photographic studio in Shortland Street. And then after her husband died, she continued to run the studio for almost 30 years. And she had 9 children. Elizabeth remarried a man called John Blackman, who was a writer and poet and had known Charles Dickens and other British authors. Hamish said there needs to be more research about these women photographers. I think he's right. On that, we want to repeat Hamish's shout out about Lisa Mitchell's book, Through Shaded Glass, Women and Photography in Aotearoa, New Zealand, 1860 to 1960, Shining the Light on New Zealand's Woman Photographers. The blurb from Museum of New Zealand Te Papa Tongarewa states, "The contribution of women to the first century of photography has been overlooked across the world, including in New Zealand. With few exceptions, photographic histories have tended to focus on the male maker. This important book tilts the balance, unearthing a large and up to now unknown number of women photographers, both professional and amateur, who operated in New Zealand from the 1860s to the 1960s, either as assistants in the early studios or later running studios in their own right. This book sounds brilliant." Now, back to our interview with Hamish. You're listening to Inside the Jewel Box. So Hamish, this is the third object that you've brought along today. Can you please describe what's in front of us?
Okay, so what we have here is the positive of the negative. This is an albumen print that will date to pretty close to the image capture, so it'll be 1880s or early 1890s, of the three guides, Sophia, Tupaya, Nareta there, and Kate Middlemass, another one of the guides there at the Pink and White Terraces. They are sitting in the maho, in the porch of Hinamihi at that time, and what we can see here is the original house in all her glory. And I say her really advisedly. Certainly, I know, within Ngāti Porou, a lot of the houses are named for female ancestresses, ancestral figures, but certainly within Te Arawa and a lot of other parts of Aotearoa, many of the houses are named for male ancestral figures within the whakapapa of that iwi. So of course, there at Ohenemutu, we have Tamati Kapua, one of the great houses of Te Arawa, which is named for the original boat captain of the Te Arawa canoe. At Lake Rotowiti, we have some of the original houses there named for Rangatihi, for Homotafiti, for Uanuku, Rākeo, ancestral figures from within Ngāti Pikiao and wider Te Arawa. It's traditionally where many of the houses have been named over the years. This particular house, Hinamihi o Te Ao Tawhito, is named for an ancestral princess. Hinamihi herself was particularly notable, as she was the keeper of, we use the word taniwha kind of advisedly, certainly a dragon or a great lizard who kind of terrorized the area. And earlier this year, I was able to visit the island where Hinamihi and Kataore lived, in Rotokakahi, just outside Rotorua. So Hinamihi and Kataore, her dragon, are figures where the line between were they real figures, are they kind of legendary figures, gets blurred a little bit. But certainly the specificity of where she lived and her personality as being the only figure who could control Kataore, who as a taniwha or a dragon was famous for his bad temper, is well known. And this house memorialises her as one of the great ancestral figures of Tūhorangi who were and are mana whenua on this land here. In the photograph, we see the three guides in their korowai, and we can see the lovely density of the carving and the kawhaiwhai and the tukutuku panels with which Hinamihi was decorated. And Hinamihi was always very well remarked upon for the kind of profuse nature of the carving and the tukutuku panels. Hinamihi was the house where tourists, visitors to the Pink and White Terraces, would be entertained prior to a visit to the Pink and White Terraces. So they would be welcomed into this space by figures such as Aporo Te Whare Kaniwha, who was Nareta's husband. Aporo was the chiefly leader who commissioned the house. The two carvers were Wero Tāroi and Tēnā Waitere. So we know a lot about Hinamihi and the history of the house and its purpose, and you could make a very clear case for Hinamihi being one of the first, if not the first, Māori examples of architecture and whakaero design specifically for the business of tourism.
Hamish, before we started recording, you talked about the comparison between potentially houses like this and churches.
Yeah.
Does that apply here?
Well, I'm not sure. I think in general terms, one of the narratives that emerges post about 1840 is two things happen that are result in this wave of great houses being built. From the period of about 1860s through to the 1890s, we have a wave of really great houses. Tamati Kapua, Homai Tawhiti, Uanuku Mai Raratonga, Kawatapu Arangi, the great proliferation of houses that stood on the hill there in Makatu, Te Pua Wai o Te Arawa, that beautiful pātaka is in the Auckland Museum, and Homai Tawhiti and Uanuku Mai Raratonga are there, back on their original marae sites around Lake Rotuiti. A couple of things happened. First, technologically, Maori carvers began to get access from about the 1830s, 1840s to metal carving tools. Up until that point, all of the carving was done with stone tools. That's one of the reasons why greenstone was so precious and traded. Frequently, a lot of the carving was done with greenstone toki. But stone tool carvers are always fighting with the grain. Carving against the grain in wood is a tricky business, and stone tools were notorious for breaking, snapping in the act of carving. So really, Maori carvers absolutely fell upon metal tools when they could get them. They could cut deeper, they could carve faster, and there was an explosion of carving from that point. That's not the only reason that was an explosion of carving. There was a kind of a transition taking place in transportation, and the highest and best use of carving up until that point had been the carving of wakatawa, canoes, and that's a very time-soaking business, carving a waka. And there's a lot that can go wrong in the carving of a waka when it comes to the floating of it and all those sorts of things. However, certainly for Tohunga Whakaero, the pinnacle carving was the carving of wakatawa. But along came horses, along came mules, along came buggies, along came bigger ships. So Maori didn't need to carve waka as much as they did. But the other thing that happened at that time was that churches were being built in Aotearoa. And if you like, the kaupapa of a church, named for God, named for a saint, the son of God, Saint this, Saint Paul, Saint Peter, Catholic churches, Presbyterian churches, whatever it might be, there were a lot of similarities in what the churches would do. Places of worship, important meetings, where important statements were made, where sermons were given, you know. Whai kōrero within a church from a priest is not dissimilar to the whai kōrero that you see on a marae. So there are a lot of things that Maori saw taking place in church structures that they felt echoed a lot of the things that they did within their own culture. And of course, Maori were very curious about Christianity, and many, you know, iwi by iwi or hapu by hapu, many became adherents to Methodists, Presbyterians, Anglicans. Again, it was a bit of an arms race for souls with, you know, missionaries in all directions in New Zealand from the 1820s. So one of the things that we see happening, emerging from about the 1850s and 60s, is the great houses. They could carve them faster because they had the metal tools, and Maori recognised that a lot of the mana of European culture travelled in and around the business of churches. And they started to... Look, I don't have access to the corridor there, but I'm sure there's some interesting research to be done in that space, and I'm sure it has been done. But certainly there's a sense that the great carved houses that began to emerge at that time were expressions of tangata whenua and mana whenua status, and that the prominence of church structures was echoed and exceeded or responded to by the Whorewhakaaro structures, and certainly they are in many cases, tamati kapua, carved in honour of great ancestral figures, where the life and the business of that particular iwi could be conducted in a way that had a bit of pomp and ceremony.
You also said alongside the technology, there were new paints coming in.
Mm. One of the things, I mean, what we don't have here is colour photography. Got black and white photography. But in my reading of a lot of the original texts around the carved houses, but also the painted houses down, for example, Rongopai, down there near Gisborne, was that as Maori house builders, house creators began to get access to European paints, they didn't hold back. So that you see some, apparently based on historical accounts, some pretty full-on colour schemes in and around the carving. And certainly in this photograph, you can see that Hinamihi is painted inside the carving with a whole variety of tones and colours. Now, it's a black and white photograph. We don't know exactly, but this sense that we have today, and this is actually quite fascinating because it's, in my reading, it's actually quite a lot about photography, was that when Maori carving started to enter museums, it started to get painted kokowai, that red cover colour that we kind of associated with, that's what a Maori carving looks like. And kokowai was employed by Pākehā museum directors so that the carvings could be more easily photographed. So there was, you didn't have the colours in the carving, the 2D and the 3D, fighting with each other in a photograph. However, when we look here at the 1880s and accounts of houses like Tokonga Nui Anoho down there in Tikawiti, that was kind of a riot of colour, was very, very colourful. And one of the parallels that I would draw is if you ever get to go to Chandigarh to see the Le Corbusier buildings. I remember as a student at university in the 1980s seeing books of the Le Corbusier buildings and going, oh my God, and it's modernist and it's sculptural and isn't it amazing, and I have to get there one day. And then when you get to Chandigarh, all those photographs are in black and white. But when you get to Chandigarh, you see that the buildings are an absolute riot of colour. Absolutely, it's the intersection of architecture, 2D, 3D, and everything else between. And as we can see in this photograph, the kawhaiwhai and the carvings themselves are very, very intricately painted, and the kawhaiwhai on the maihi there are actually painted. So that Hinamihi was both a painted house and a carved house. And this is an image which goes to show how intricately the makers, Wero and Tene, thought about the decoration of the house. And of course that kind of stands to reason because this was tourism land. You know, this was put on a great show for visitors. So Hinamihi, from its earliest days, the historic accounts talk about how beautiful the house was, how expressive it was. There's also a legend that instead, in the inside of the house, for the eyes, instead of power shell, that she had coins in the eyes. So it was called, referred to colloquially as the House of the Golden Eyes. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But certainly Hinamihi had a bit of bling about her and put on a great show for visitors to the Pink and White Terraces. It was all part of the experience for tourists coming in the 1880s.
This brings us to the end of our interview with Hamish. Hamish had so many interesting things to say. It was an enlightening interview.
That's so true. He really challenged us on our perhaps reductive view of this time in our country's history. In the way he talked about Maori and the use of technology in carving and colours very early on, and then in talking about women, the guides at Rotorua, photographers like Elizabeth Pullman, he made it very clear that those early contact periods and that early settlement phase were much more entangled with each side learning from one another. We mistakenly think a lot of the appropriation debate in this country starts with Gordon Walters in the 1980s. We'd be better to look back earlier to see that both Maori and settlers had agency in how they interacted and what they learnt from one another. So it's a real reminder of that so much of our histories are still hidden, they're not written, they're not known, and they're invisible. And the more we know, the more it makes our past richer for all of us. So thank you to Hamish Coney. You can follow more of Hamish's world and projects on his own Instagram, Hamish N. Coney. And thank you for listening to Inside the Jewel Box. To see images of the works we've talked about in this episode, please see our Instagram, Inside the Jewel Box.